All the great stories in Genesis are knots of ambiguity. And sometimes I think that's their ultimate meaning, the lesson they teach, that the great events in our lives and in history are so ambiguous and dense you can't unravel them. You can only start to feel the webs of meaning at work in them. So here are three ways to look at the story of the binding of Isaac. Three ways. The first way. Abraham thinks that God is demanding this, that he sacrifice his son, but maybe Abraham went mad. Religious genius is, of course, always halfway to madness. We all know that. Plato says that. Shakespeare says that. Prophets, poets, and madmen are all near allied. So maybe Abraham's religious genius became so intense that it finally broke him. And he mistook some evil thing, some evil impulse for God. So he was about to kill his son, driven by his own craziness. But at the last moment, he woke up. Maybe God woke him up, or maybe he woke himself up from the nightmare. Or maybe Abraham was so close to God that God, too, was part of the craziness, and maybe God, too, woke up. I mention this view, that perhaps it was madness, Abraham's madness and possibly God's madness, because in Abraham's time, people did sacrifice their children. And I'm especially aware that in the Middle East of today, there are people who don't like us, who don't like Jews, who don't like the West, who sometimes hear voices they take to be divine, telling them to do the worst thing in the world, the worst things in the world, including even sacrificing their own sons and daughters. And this is where we do want to say, stop it, stop it. If God is real, surely God speaks. But every message in a human brain can be distorted by that brain. We must test every message with reason, with feeling, with love. That's what the Greek philosopher Socrates says. Listen to the oracle. Listen to the oracle, but test the oracle. We all have intuitions. We all have premonitions. But we always have to test them rationally. Every divine voice Abraham had ever heard could pass the test of reason, feeling, and love, but not this one. The story can be read that way, the story of a madness which almost triumphs, but not quite, over divinity and humanity. A madness of God, of religion, overcome just before midnight. Here's the second interpretation. The story is all about karma. All the stories in Genesis about the matriarchs and patriarchs can be described roughly as stories about karma, about meaningful patterns in life. What goes around comes around. What you do comes back at you. Your fate, as the psychologist Jung says, and as the philosopher Hegel had already said, your fate, your destiny, your fate is just the suppressed part of your character coming back at you from the other side of the world. So what was Abraham's weakness? He was inconceivably great, but he still had a weakness. What was it? All the commentators know Abraham's weakness. He was too kind. He was too much about love, about kindness. For example, when the king of Egypt fell in love with Abraham's wife, Sarah, the most beautiful woman in the world, Abraham lets God take care of the problem. He lets God save his marriage. He couldn't think of anything else to do. It was a tough situation, but if Abraham had been as good at toughness as he was at love, he could have taken care of it and not relied on miracles to protect his family. Or again, when there were evil cities in the world, really evil cities, cities of rape and murder and greed, and God wanted to destroy them, Abraham rightly reminds God to be just, not to hurt the innocent, and God loves Abraham for it. But Abraham doesn't try to face, to take in just how evil the evil is. Abraham can believe there is goodness everywhere, and surely there is. He sees this goodness everywhere. But what's less natural to Abraham is facing down evil, calling evil by its true name. And maybe Abraham wasn't even tough enough to keep his family together. You know, he had to send Ishmael away. God finally told him to, because Ishmael and Isaac, his two sons, weren't good for one another. They were hurting one another. And yet, maybe a father who was as tough as he was loving might have seen the disaster coming and stopped it. You see what I mean? Sometimes you have to be tough to get what is finally the most loving result. And in situations like that, Abraham, who stands for love, our commentators say, but not severity, he lacks severity. In situations that call for severity, Abraham doesn't seem perfect. Now, this is karma. We're never complete. We're always partial people. Even the greatest among us, partial. If you're human, you're finite, you're partial. And so maybe we're not tough enough. Maybe we're not loving enough. Maybe we're too mystical. Maybe we're too practical. Maybe we feel too much or think too much, and whatever it is we're not getting, it comes back at us. So many spiritual traditions say it. It comes back at us from the other side of the world. It's our karma. So Abraham, who is all about kindness and never willing to be tough, hears the voice of God saying to do the toughest, cruelest thing. Defeat the love in your heart. Take your only son, your only one, Isaac, whom you love, and make him a sacrifice. Here's a third interpretation. It's the hardest to talk about, but it's perhaps the one that interests me most. All across the history of religion, anyone who even glimpses what God is has the impression at that instant that God is all. God is everything. Only God is real enough to matter. God is very polite, very courteous, and God lets us believe ourselves to be real. The divine politeness, the divine courtesy, God lets us believe ourselves to be real, but when we see what God is, the real reality, we don't feel so real anymore. Dust and ashes, we call ourselves. Therefore, we should give God everything, everything we have, everything we are. Finally, most difficult of all, everything we love. And that's why religion can go mad in its deepest dimensions. Some people have happy, gentle relations with God. They feel intimations, the spark of the sacred, something higher glimpsed in something lower, nothing more than that. But anyone who senses the divine enormity may be tempted to say, God is everything, already everything. And to prove that I know this, anything I have, anything I am, anything I love must flow back to God. Even in human relations, something a little like this happens. A man falls in love and he wants to do everything for the woman he loves, risk everything, give her everything, sacrifice everything. But in his heart, he hopes she'll refuse. He'll offer her everything because she is everything to him. But he hopes she'll refuse so he can still exist. He wants to exist even if it's just to be worthy of her love. Well, lovers never get it quite right. They don't offer enough. They can't. Or they take too much. They can't help it. Or they give too much and lose too much, and then they resent their love. But God and Abraham in this story get it right. The story terrifies me. I'm not always confident I should even try to interpret it. But it comes around on this special day every year. Our religion does not give us a choice. We have to read and interpret this difficult story. Please don't think I think I'm making sense of it for you. No one can really do that. But I like to believe in this story, God and Abraham get the balance right. Abraham hears God ask for everything, and he somehow he feels he can offer it, but he also knows God won't take it. He knows that. We'll both come down from the mountain, says Abraham to his servants. And they do. God will provide the sacrifice, Abraham says. And God does, but it's a ram. It's not Isaac. It's a traditional interpretation that Abraham knew. He knew. He prophetically saw what would happen on the mountain. Maybe Abraham knew before God did what would happen on that mountain. So these are three interpretations, and perhaps you could put them together and tell me what you come up with, because they're best together. First, the story is about madness. Second, the story is about karma. Third, the story is about how we can exist. How we can exist even if God is everything. But in saying all this, I've been focusing perhaps too much on Abraham. And the Jewish people might, as Elie Wiesel says, identify more with Isaac in this story. We've been haunted for 2,000 years by the sense that God, or some power deep in history, wants our annihilation. And just before I was born, it really seemed that the sacrifice might be carried out, that God might not provide the ram, that God might really let us die. Elie Wiesel and others ask if Isaac could have even desired to live after what happened on Mount Moriah. Holocaust survivors couldn't always re-enter life. They couldn't always learn to trust life again. They had seen too much horror, and yet, Isaac, who survived the most monstrous ordeal we can conceive, because it was the kindest father, suddenly turning against you to kill you. What could be more horrible than that? Isaac survived that ordeal, and he did re-enter life. He fell in love. He married, he had two fine sons, and his name does not mean trauma, his name means laughter. Isaac is always laughing. There's also the question of the ram, who really is sacrificed on Mount Moriah. Sandy is always asking me about the ram. You see, someone really dies. Someone really dies, the ram dies. But the ram's horn becomes the shofar, announcing the new year. And we honor the ram. We remember the ram in the last part of our morning service. But first, we have a Haftorah reading in memory of our mysterious ancestors, and especially of Abraham, who was willing to do this. God will redeem us. God will redeem us even from hands stronger than our own. And there will be joy, such joy, the joy we dream of.